Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I want to finish this story, and then we'll move on to John, who's called in from Toronto with a question about the word Adonai. The information, this is according to the BBC, the information the CIA collected using quote-unquote enhanced interrogation techniques, that would be torture folks, failed to secure information that foiled any threats, the report said. So using the information provided by the CIA, itself admits in its review of these techniques that they did not come up with anything that foiled any threat, much less an actual attack. Nothing, folks. Nothing. You know, if they had something, they would have touted it. They have nothing. You know, it's like the NSA spying, and Dianne Feinstein came up with David Headley as the example. When anybody that had taken any amount of time to study what is known about David Headley, in fact, just Google his name on Wikipedia, David Headley, and you'll find that there's nothing associated with the NSA that contributed to forestalling David Headley perpetrating a terrorist attack on the United States. And you'll find that David Headley was, in fact, a double agent being paid by the CIA at the time that he perpetrated the terrorist attack in Mumbai, India, a terrorist attack that the FBI and CIA knew of in advance and did nothing to stop. Now, if they're willing to tout David Headley as an example of something that they did that was beneficial in the NSA program, when it's about the most reprehensible thing you could ever read about the United States and its intelligence community, you think that if they could find anything that would justify these acts of heinous torture, they would, and they got nothing. They claim that it led to bin Laden and to a courier, when in fact bin Laden was tracked down because of a vaccine program, which put back vaccinations in the Muslim world decades, and lots of Muslim boys and girls will get polio and the measles because they no longer trust vaccines, because they're a CIA scam. They always thought they were, and now they know they are. Moreover, the one person who actually talked, of all of the individuals that we kidnapped, of all of them, and we weren't at war with a nation. So, I mean, you have to call it a kidnapping because it was not an act of war. We didn't declare war on any nation. So, we kidnapped them. And there's only one that provided useful testimony. And he provided all of his useful testimony before he was tortured. After he was tortured, he climbed up and said nothing. And 100% of the information that was given by those who were tortured was all made up just to have the pain go away. That's what the report says. That's the truth. And so when Dick Cheney claims that lives were saved, that there was some benefit in this, he is lying, and he knows he's lying. And let me tell you something, folks. If there were terrorist acts that were thwarted, Islamic acts of vengeance against Americans that were thwarted because of the torture still would not have been justified. If you want to know what Islam is going to do and why it's going to do it, read Prophet of Doom. It's free online. Prophetofdoom.net. Tell you everything you need to know. You don't need to torture people, and there's never an excuse for torturing people, even if there were the possibility that torture would protect lives. You don't do it. We still don't get it. Mr. Cheney said the interrogation program saved lives and the agency deserved credit, not condemnation. I think that since the man is so willing to take responsibility since he thinks this is such a great idea, send him over to The Hague. Let's see how he fares in an international tribunal. It did, in fact, produce actionable intelligence that was vital in the success in keeping the country safe from future attacks. He can't name a single instance, because there are none. And even if he could, which he can't, it wouldn't justify torture. The United Nations and human rights groups have called for the prosecution of U.S. officials involved in the program running from 2001 to 2007. The United Nations is calling for the prosecution of U.S. officials. As a matter of international law, the U.S. is legally obliged, sorry for my tongue twisting here today, as a matter of international law, the U.S. is legally obliged to bring those responsible to justice, said Ben Emmerson, UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counterterrorism. He said this in a statement he made from Geneva. He said there has been a clear policy of implementing terror that was orchestrated at a very high level. He's right. The United Nations needs to have these men brought to justice. George Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, George Tenet, and the subsequent heads of the CIA. Probably the Attorney General at the time of the United States who provided the legal cover for what was absolutely illegal. Unconstitutional in America, illegal internationally. Should be prosecuted in the United States, should be prosecuted by the United Nations, should be prosecuted by the International Court in The Hague. That's the right thing to do. Dick Cheney wants to take responsibility, wants to take credit. Give it to him. Hello, John. I understand you've been holding for a while. I'm sorry. I wanted to get through this material before we changed topics, but I believe you have a question on the a Hebrew word Adonai.
Yeah, that's okay, Yara. And I also wanted to thank you for your recommendation when you told me to check out the Book of Job.
Yes.
It did provide some comfort. That whole thing eventually came to an end.
Good.
One of the things that I wanted to let your audience know is when it was at its very worst, like I felt like I was going to die and like die in a bad way, like a Sheol kind of a way. I guess the Sabbath struck or whatever, and instantly it stopped. And I felt so God isn't a liar. When he says that the Sabbath is a day of rest, he's telling the truth.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just wanted to let you guys know that. And yeah, I'd recommend the audience checks out the Book of Job as well. It's a really good read.
Yeah, the Book of Job is actually a really interesting read. It's a, you know, it's a story that we have very little context for. And I think that we have very little context because no context is needed. We don't really know the context of time. We don't know the context of place. We don't know, but we suspect that Job was written and that it took place prior to the Torah being recited to Moshe. And the reason that time and place are irrelevant is that the story is true throughout time. It is a story that is has no basis in any one place. It's a story about the potential influence in people's lives of Hasatan and his fallen Moloch envoys, and how they can and cannot influence those or affect those that have a relationship with Yahweh. And so it's a marvelous story that tells us how they operate, what their limitations are, and how the relationship that Yahweh has in the covenant between individuals and himself is the single most important thing, and that ultimately it can't be harmed by demonic influence. So that's the story. It is, but it's a marvelous read, and there's a great deal of prophecy in it. There's a wonderful insights in it. It's a very enlightening book, and you know, one of the things you have to be careful though in the book of Job is that much of Job is not inspired. You know, and it's like much of what we read in the prophets and Psalms is not inspired. Now, what I mean by that is, even in some of the things in the Torah, if you read in the Torah that you know, Abraham was having a discussion with some potentate someplace, and he said this, that, and the other thing, that's not God inspiring him to say that, this, that, and the other thing. God's presenting a flawed individual engaged in human activity. And it's important to know what he said and what the response was and what the consequence was. You know, there's lots of things that David did and said, for example, that were inappropriate. But it's important for us to know the full nature of these characters so we don't misrepresent the kind of individual that can engage in a relationship and partake in the covenant with Yahweh. So there are things in Job where you have the various associates and friends of Job providing advice and Job responding to them that are just their thoughts, their conversations, so that we get to know their mindset. And, you know, that part of the story is interesting to read. It's just that sometimes people make mistakes and to say, well, that's an example for us. And it's not, Yana, but read it with that perspective. Go ahead.
Yeah. One of the parallels that I actually got with my experience from the book of Job is at one point when it was really bad, I was actually arguing with my wife and she had left, and it was the Sabbath, right? And I had mm-hmm. like, what I thought was a profound moment with God, where I felt like he was protecting me, kind of a thing. And I asked, are you still here? And what I got as like a sort of response was, where were you? And that's the exact same thing that he said to Job, was, where were you when I created, you know, reality, or, you know, the sun?
Really, where were you? Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in our relationship, that is really always the case. God's always available. Where were we? And sometimes we get a little too big for our britches and say, well, you know, isn't God this, that, and the other thing, therefore he can't do this. He said, where were you when I created the universe? A thorough examination, not really thorough, but certainly a summation of the benefit of the book of Job, which, you know, again, I just, for our listeners, we don't very often talk about Job in this program. I recommended it to John when he called a month or so ago. But the book of Job is extraordinarily good for helping to understand the relationship that we have with Yahweh, how our trials and tribulations in this life, and we all have them, are just so insignificant compared to a eternal covenant relationship with Yahweh, that we ought to keep that in mind. We also ought to keep in mind that God's not the source of every trinket. He does not micromanage our lives. And it tells us the limitations of the demonic host. And yet it also expresses Yahweh's relationship with the demonic host. I mean, there's a purpose for Satan. And he serves his purpose. So it's a marvelous presentation of all of those things, but it has to be read recognizing that you're reading a story that took place between men, and the dialogue between men do not always represent that which you should follow by way of example. It's men's responses to things, and there's a great lesson in it. All right, so you have a question on Adonai.
Yeah, before we move on to Adonai, I just had one more insight that I gained from my experience. Okay. I actually feel better than I have in my entire life, and I've suffered from insomnia for, like, since I was 12 years old. I'm 28 now, and mm-hmm. after this ordeal ended, I don't suffer from it anymore.
Okay.
So that was just strange. But one insight that I had was about Satan. And you know how he's described as Barack Obama or the lightning from heaven, the lightning that fell from heaven?
I wouldn't describe him as I wouldn't give Barack Obama that much credit. He is described as a flashing light from heaven. Yeah, that is how Yahusha describes him. Now, Yahusha spoke Hebrew when he was speaking to his disciples, so he would not have used either of those Aramaic terms. And Yahusha said, I saw him fall from heaven, and this is what he looked like, falling from heaven. And then his Hebrew discussion was translated into Greek. And then when Paul wrote his testimony, he, of course, wrote it in Greek, and he used exactly the same Greek word that translated what Yahusha said in his depiction of the flashing light on the road to Damascus. It's one of a thousand proofs that Paul was demonically possessed and spoke on behalf of Satan.
Yeah, so what I wanted to tell you is the lightning or the light from heaven is a vast, vast understatement, is what I came to understand. Imagine being so close to the creator of the universe, and then in an instant, I guess in like a flash of light, being diametrically opposed and like a magnet, how repelled you would be from and repulsed from God you would be. So that's actually a more, I think, apt description of what his fall was actually like and how much, you know, power and mojo went into that.
You know, the one Moloch is bright, but one Moloch is not so bright that that a human can't interact with a single Moloch. They aren't going to blow us away with their power. And while we would see them as bright light and a form of bright light, they're not going to blow us away. But when you're dealing with HaSatan, the adversary, he took a third of the heavenly host with him. And so he took a third of the Moloch with him. Now, if you have the energy required to expel that many Moloch at one time, you know, that's and their energy themselves, yeah, I would assume that was quite the sight to see at that particular time. But I'm always very careful trying to help people understand that HaSatan and his ilk are extraordinarily limited and are blamed for far more than they actually are responsible for. They have no free will. They're very limited, therefore, in creativity. And Yanoa has fairly strict limitations as to what he will allow them to do. So their primary purpose is to present a alternative to the covenant, an alternative to Yahweh, so that the choice is clear, so that the choice is ours, and so that there really is a choice. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. When I hear the word Adonai, there are two things that I always think about. First is that Adonai is a combination of Adon, and the Y at the end of it makes it first person. So it is as Adon, it's my lord, my master, my owner. The one who possesses me. Adon is one of two potential ways to vocalize the Hebrew word that can also be vocalized, Edon. Every time that the three letters that comprise the Hebrew word are used in the Torah, it is always Edon. And Edon is a very important term. Edon means upright pillar. It's always depicted in the Torah, Edon is the upright pillar that serves to hold up and enlarge the tent of the witness and the tabernacle. So it's a very important concept. It's the upright one, the one who stands up for us, the one who secures and enlarges the home here on earth for Yahweh's family. So a very powerful concept as Edon. And Edonai was used by the Masoretes to replace Yahweh's name all 7,000 times that it appears in the Torah prophets and Psalms. So it's a pretty sinister term from that point of view. And Edon is one of the two Hebrew words that conveys Lord. The primary Hebrew word for Lord is Baal. The secondary is Edon. Adonis, the Greek god that was also called the Lord by the Greeks. Adonis is based on Edon. So what other questions do you have about Edonai, John?
Oh, that really cleared things up for me because I was reading what it says on the internet and what the Tanakh says and stuff. The reason it came about is because I was speaking with a Jewish individual yesterday, and he was telling me that Gehinnom was hell, and I was like, no, Gehinnom is a place outside of Jerusalem or whatever, and he was insistent. So I started looking at some of these other terms as well, and I wanted to have it cleared up.
Yeah, let's talk about Gehinnom, and I'll go back to Edonai and why it's misunderstood.
Sure.
Gehinnom was the trash dump. If you look at Jerusalem, it is it's three ridges and three valleys, and the ridges and the valleys have different purposes. But Gehinna was the valley outside of the, kind of a ravine, if you will, outside of Jerusalem that was used for trash. It's where they dumped their rubbish. And there were fires that burned there trying to, burn the rubbish. So constantly fires burning, constantly the rot and stink of trash. It was the landfill, if you will. Before we engineered such things. And so Gehinna was used metaphorically to describe Sheol. Sheol is the pit. It's the place of questioning. It's the place of separation from Yahweh. And so Sheol is really the English concept of hell is based upon a Greek god's name, Hades. And so it's based upon a Greek god's name. And so there really is no place called hell from Yahweh's perspective. It is Sheol from Yahweh's perspective. It means to question. Those who are questioned regarding their behavior in leading people away from Yahweh will be there. And it is total separation from Yahweh is what is represented by Sheol. And Yahweh does refer metaphorically to Sheol with a reference at least once to the Valley of Gehenna because of the rotting flesh and the fact that that's what is just thrown away. The garbage
right.
of humanity that is thrown away is there. So it's really metaphor.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, the rotting flesh and the garbage kind of thing. When I was having my experience, if you want to call it that, I would get constant whiffs of sulfur or like rotting garbage, and that seems to be what these things smelled like.
Yeah, that's what Gehinna would have smelled like, so it's a really effective metaphor. And Yahweh is really good with his metaphors to describe what Sheol will be like and who goes there. I mean, it's what's discarded from humanity is what ends up there. As for a rabbi advancing Adonai, the rabbi would know for certain that Yahweh's name, Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, is pronounceable because it's written with the same 22 letters that comprise all of the many thousands of words found in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Same letters, all pronounced the same way, with five of the 22 letters being vowels. He knows that. He knows that even Josephus wrote about the fact that Yahweh's name was comprised of four vowels. One of the letters is repeated, so it's really three vowels, but one used twice. He knows that. And he knows that that during the Babylonian captivity, that the religious leadership of Yisrael during the captivity were called Yehudims. They found that deeply offensive. They were called Yahoos, which is the name of the website now. They were called Yahoos, mocking the name of Yahweh, mocking their name, which is Yahudim, related to Yah. And so they made it a law amongst themselves never to say Yahweh's name. And it was punishable by death if you were to say Yahweh's name. And the initial impetus for doing that was the captivity in Babylon, where Yahweh and his people, Yahudim, were named Yahus. So the rabbis then, to avoid saying his name, knew that it would be a grievous offense to change the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, to replace, to erase Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh and to replace it with Adonai. So what they did is they wrote Adonai above Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh, so that when the passage was recited out loud, the reader, the religious leader in the synagogue, would say Adonai as opposed to read Yahweh. And that's how, what they did. And then what you find later is that as the religion became better established and the rabbis usurped all of the power of Yahweh for themselves, they simply later eliminated Yahweh's name and wrote Adonai in its place. And then English translators, rather than, even though they knew that Yahweh's name was there instead, translated Adonai as opposed to replicating and transliterating Yahweh's name. That's the history of it. And any rabbi who's going to be arguing these points online, they're going to know that history. What I've just shared with you is very common knowledge.
Right. And it's a repeat. Can I ask you a favor, Yada?
Sure.
During the third hour, could you please read God's Word and the Torah and from your book, Yada Yah, or Invitation to Meet God, instead of talking about Paul the whole time? Because, I'm pretty sick of hearing about Paul.
and I've received four or five letters here recently echoing those same sentiments. Thus far, I haven't changed course. I may. I don't know when I will. I mean, I absolutely am going to change course. It just depends on what time. And really, the reason that I haven't changed course is really a number of reasons. First, if you listen to yesterday's program, the day before that, all I read from was the Torah. I was reading the Torah's presentation of Devarim 13 and 18. So I was, in fact, reading from the Torah. Second, I have a show Friday evenings beginning at 4:30 Pacific, 7:30 Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio, where the entire subject is the Torah. Third, the purpose, when it started Shattering Myths, the primary purpose was to shatter myths, was to expose those things which were false, and then to encourage people and lead them to that which is true. And there is no myth more debilitating in America. There is no lie that is more important to expose and condemn than Christianity. Now, I realize that most of the listeners, the most active listeners to this program, both live and through the archives, are a member of the covenant, that they have considered what Yahweh had to say. And frankly, John, anybody who considers what Yahweh has to say with an open mind falls in love with him. And they embrace the terms and conditions of the covenants. It's the best offer that's ever been made. You know, you'd be absolutely out of your mind not to fall in love with them and to accept the covenant. And so the vast preponderance of those who listen to the show on a regular basis have read Introduction to God, have read yadayah.com, intro to god.org, yadayah.com, and most have read questioningpaul.com. And are a member of the covenant and definitely prefer to talk about topics that are relevant to for those of us who are part of the covenant family. And I recognize that, and I've done a lot of that over the past 3 years. But there's also a larger audience, much larger, in the hundreds of millions as opposed to in the thousands, that is still corrupted by the religion of Christianity. And I don't know of anyone else out there who's willing to expose and condemn the religion of Christianity based upon its founder, Paul. Somebody needs to be doing it. Welcome back to Shattering Myths, having a conversation with John about a topic that comes up often. I'm giving you my unvarnished perspective on this. John, I want you to know that I'm not negating what you've said, because what you've said I've received from many, many people in letters over the past few months. So it is it's a common theme. I have not received a single letter from anyone saying, you know, what we really need is more ammunition to denounce and reject Paul. And I'm receiving many letters that says, I really wish you'd go back to the Torah in the third hour. The reason I have not is several, and I've shared those with our listeners and with you. But the primary reason is that there are millions, hundreds of millions of Christians. In fact, there's probably 2.5 billion of them. Not all of those speak English or would even have access to our archives, although I will tell you that the blessyahweh.com site that Richard sponsors, that site is visited by people from over 100 different countries. And so we do reach the world through it. And that there are 2.5 billion people that have been beguiled by Christianity. And while they are Christian, there is no chance that they will come to know Yahweh, that they will engage in the covenant, or that they will be saved. They have to be freed, and I can't free them, but I can at least give them the information necessary for them to begin to question their religion and then at least be in a position to move in the right direction towards God.
Oh, yeah, I understand that.
And so that's the reason for it in this forum, while in the other forum and the thing we do on the Shabbat with the Torah study on Blog Talk Radio, we do just Torah. And I'm going to share one other reason with you, John, and then I'm going to offer a compromise. And I'm doing this on behalf of many people, some of which I'm really close to, who have made this request. I don't think, John, there is anybody else out there willing to expose and condemn Paul both in writing and as part of an oral presentation. And these programs get put on YouTube. They get put on a variety of different sites. They reach people in many different ways. I don't think there's anybody else doing it. There is one other site that I'm aware of called Jesus's Words Only. But while there are many things on that site that are useful, it's still a Christian religious site, and that's a shame. But I don't think there's anybody else doing it, and it's something that desperately needs to be done. Now, throughout this presentation of Paul, rather than just read what I have in questioning Paul, what I've attempted to do is to substantially augment it. And almost all of the augmentation is designed to express who Yahweh is, what he is like, what the covenant is about, how you participate in it, what its benefits are, and how those things are superior to and different than the religion of Christianity. So sometimes knowing what something is not gives us a wonderful opportunity to contrast it with what the truth is. Now, here's the compromise, John. Let me show the compromise, and I want to get your feedback.
Sure.
I want to continue with questioning Paul until we come back to the comprehensive presentation of what Yahweh inspired his prophet Chabaouk Habacuc to write 666 years before Paul penned this letter to the Galatians. I want to go through it in detail, Yahweh's, because that'll again be, we're going back to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. I want everyone to have to think about what Yahweh himself had to tell us about this man, because God had a lot to say about him, and God despises him. Fair enough? And at that point, once we've done that, which will be a return to the prophets, we will pick a topic. We've been through the covenant. We've been through creation. We've been through the flood. We'll pick a topic, and we will present it as part of this program. Maybe the one that I'm leaning towards right now is the eyewitness accounts written 1,000 years before the events of our salvation.